Fred Matthews, let's begin with you. Some leaders in the community this morning are saying they're worried that this jury might actually deadlock.
It is a relatively tense time. I think folks were surprised at the top of the week when the prosecution rested so early, it appeared, without the second detective being called. And then the defense basically took the case and did not initially call Mr. Dunn. And the judge gave instructions as if Mr. Dunn was not going to take the stand. And then finally, Mr. Dunn takes the stand, and it's not very exciting. It's not very exciting. There's not a strong examination from the state of Mr. Dunn. And although you see two sides, the weeping, sobbing, 6'3", 250-pound man crying at the stand. But when the state got a hold of him, all of a sudden, the sobs go away, no more crying. He's running his case sort of guy, the very sort of thing that I thought defense lawyers wouldn't let you do. You know, don't talk so much, yes and no. So the community is watching, and now we're entering day three of deliberations, and everybody's saying, well, what are they looking at? What are they doing?
They've asked to review footage. Mark Woods, Florida Times Union. This will be their third day of deliberating. They've asked to review the surveillance footage. They've asked for a number of pieces of evidence to go over again, being very thorough with this evidence.
Right, and we don't know, you know, whether they're thinking guilty or not guilty. They might also be weighing, you know, is it first degree? You know, that would be, you know, it's hard to imagine them finding him not guilty. But so I would guess, I'm far from a legal expert, but I would guess they're sitting there trying to decide first degree, second degree, you know, what, and there's a variety of charges. There's also the attempted murder with the other three teenagers, Jordan Davis. So there's multiple things for them to consider. It's that part, I think, can probably get complex and is why a jury might be going over a lot of things.
Right, and we'll go to your calls about the conclusion of the Michael Dunn trial. It could come today. The number to join us is 549-2937. Jeff Billman, Mark Woods just said, it's hard to imagine this jury acquitting Michael Dunn. Of course, the nation is watching the outcome of this trial because it comes so closely on the heels of the acquittal of George Zimmerman down in Central Florida.
Yes, and there aren't, I think the biggest difference between this case and that case on some level is that there are witnesses here, and there weren't witnesses in so you had the witness, you had the word of George Zimmerman versus a dead kid, and the dead kid can't talk. In this case, you do have other people, and you have, you know, you have footage, and you have police that were dispatched to the scene, and you had, you know, this gun that doesn't exist, and the shotgun that, you know, vanished into thin air. And so I think that makes it much more difficult for this defense team than Mark O'Meara when he was in Sanford and the Zimmerman case.
Let's talk about that. That I think will be the most critical question, whether they find credible Michael Dunn's assertion, Fred, that Jordan Davis and his pals had a weapon. No evidence of that whatsoever.
Well, that's the key, though, isn't it? Nobody would have seen that except the kids in the car, in the SUV, and Mr. Dunn, who thought what he thought he saw. And was he afraid? Probably for that few seconds he was, because this is where the issues come to play of race and class and generation. This is something that he doesn't like necessarily, and he had no real appreciation for the music he heard and all that. And this is what he saw on television, and I can believe, as many folks can believe, that he thought he saw what he thought he saw. And it doesn't matter what else took place. And the problem, the one piece that's missing here is that, no, the detectives didn't go to the next lot over to look in the trash cans and all of that. But Mr. Dunn says he saw this first shiny object, then on the witness stand, he said they banged the door with it, and then the gentleman gets out, but he gets out with no weapon. And that's where Mr. Dunn's recollection falls apart.
Mark Woods.
And I mean, that's part of the galling part, is that, you know, the defense arguing, well, they didn't search for this, for a guy who drove away, went back to his hotel, goes back to Melbourne, and then is going to say, you didn't search for a gun. Well, they had no reason to be searching for a gun.
And he never, I mean, you know, it belies credibility to me that he saw a gun, felt his life was threatened, shot at this car, what, 9 times, didn't call the cops, drove off, didn't mention the gun to his girlfriend in this long drive down the coast, stopped at a bed and breakfast. You know, at some point, these things just don't add up. Either the man has, you know, no sense of empathy or no sense of the bigger picture here, or he talked to this cop a little later and said, well, geez, I'm going to have some trouble if they didn't have a gun.
Well, I mean, I can, to an extent, you can understand, believe it or not, him running initially.
Running, yes.
But... Because of what happened, the trauma of it. Mm-hmm. This has never happened to him in his life. A number of folks carry the gun in the glove compartment. And this happens in a flash. Mm-hmm. As anybody in combat will tell you, it happens in a flash. You don't remember it all. So the flight idea is one thing. But once you had a moment to realize it, you stop and you call and you mm-hmm. say, okay, hey, you know, I did this. I didn't mean to. That's the problem. But again, you know, it is just hard to justify, which is what the jury has to deal with.
You know, Mark Woods, let me get your thoughts on this. There have been many studies done on perception and subconscious racial bias. All different demographic groups are more likely to see a non-existent weapon. It could be a cell phone, a backpack. They think it's a gun when it's in the hands of a young African-American male. That has been proven over and over and over again. It's been studied exhaustively. And what hasn't come up in this trial is that this defendant could very well have seen a completely non-existent weapon in his mind.
I mean, remember just what, less than a decade ago, here in Jacksonville, on the South Side, took a couple from Canada vacationing here. The wife goes out. She's assaulted by this black male who's identified face-to-face by the husband. The young man is convicted, only to find out that that was not the black male teenager that did it.
Yeah,
you know, eyewitness testimony. I saw him. That's him. It wasn't him.
The unreliability of what an eyewitness believes they think they saw has been proven over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's kind of part of the scary part of all this is going back to your idea of perception.
Yeah,
that doesn't have to be a real threat. It has to be a perceived threat for for self defense to work, for stand your ground. And I know that this isn't a stand your ground case, but.
But didn't the defense attorney bring it up in his closing argument?
Yes,
said to wrap the stand your ground law around Michael Dunn,
and it was in the and it was in the judge's instructions.
But that idea that it doesn't have to be a real threat; it has to be perceived. So if somebody is scared because of this perception, that can be
that's one of my issues with the law at large is this perception versus reality. I can say, I find you threatening right now. Can I shoot you? I mean, you know, at what point does your perception, your innate biases?
Yeah, that's where critics are saying the law is being misapplied and that it does feed into people's subconscious racial bias. But we want to know what you think. Lots of calls, 549-2937 to join the show. Mike on the West Side. Hello, Mike. Good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I think the first thing that struck me, Melissa, you just raised a question about some things that weren't presented. One of the other things that I saw was that, if he was getting out of the car and his head cleared the top, how is it that every shot went through the door before it hit him? And why wasn't more of an issue made of that? But the real question I have is the charges, the charge of premeditated murder. I think most reasonable people who are falling on the side of Dunn is probably guilty, probably feel that, he murdered the kid, or he did something, he came at it with a flawed perception, whatever, but he should be held responsible and accountable for this. And I think a lot of people, my wife was just questioning this morning about, why are they charging him with premeditated murder? The charge doesn't seem to really fit. And I think a lot of, Angela Corey has been criticized in the past before for overcharging people or mischarging people. I've heard the criticism that maybe mischarges led to the Zimmerman acquittal, maybe even a lack of confidence. Can you guys speak to that, maybe either the level of effort or confidence that went into this trial on behalf of the prosecutors, or maybe the charges that were leveled, maybe they weren't the right ones? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you, Mike.
Fred.
Well, you always overcharge, especially in a high-profile case like this. It's standard operating procedure for any state attorney, this is not unusual because something can stick. That's really the bottom line here. I mean, from first-degree murder to second-degree murder. And remember, these charges and the instructions given to the jury were all discussed ad nauseum between the judge, the defense attorney, and the state attorney. But the state attorney in charged with everything they could to make sure something sticks so that he can get convicted of something coming out of this. So it's not unusual. It's not right. But that's what it is. And that's what makes our system about winning and not necessarily about justice.
Well, I did notice in the, you know, we're going to have this another high-profile case, this Tampa shooting.
That's the older man in Tampa that shot somebody in a movie theater.
Retired police officer.
Yeah. Killed him.
The charges are second degree, I noticed.
Uh-huh.
You know, again, I'm not a legal expert, but that, again, there does seem to be some similarities. And if that's what those prosecutors went after was second degree, I think there is some strategy on what you charge.
Well, there also is the moment in time that they have to discuss that means first degree, that means premeditation. In the instructions, there is a moment in time. It is not defined what that, how much time it is you have to think about whether or not you're going to do this, whether or not it's premeditated. And that's the ether here that the jury has to deal with. How long does it take him to decide the moment in time that makes it premeditated?
My understanding is, you know, when you talk about premeditation and the sort of common conception that I think about that I'm going to kill you for a good long period of time isn't necessarily legally how it works. It's what sort of what Fred was talking about. You make that decision and then you act on it. It's not, you have time to think.
David tweets the show. I believe state attorney Corey has overcharged the case. It should have been second degree murder or manslaughter. We'll go back to your calls in just a moment. But what about this piece of evidence too? What about the fact that Mr. Dunn's girlfriend testified that he never once mentioned seeing a weapon in the SUV full of teens?
It's pretty devastating.
I mean, that was the interesting part. She showed up as a witness for the state. Mm-hmm. Her appearance on the stand was not as a witness for the defense. She was a witness for the state. And that was her weeping testimony the first time. And in their rebuttal case, the state brought her back to ask specifically that question. And she said no.
And I mean, we got to keep in mind the reason the cops didn't search for this weapon when, like, as the defense attorney brought up, is because they ran. They fled. They fled the area. They didn't just flee the crime scene. They fled the area. And they didn't call the cops. And they didn't say, hey, you know, these kids were pointing a shotgun at me and I had to react. So you might want to go search for the shotgun. So, I mean, yeah, there are all sorts of credibility problems with this guy.
Let's go to Omar on the west side. Hi, Omar. Thanks for holding. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I called the show last year sometime before we had a discussion, or you guys had a discussion about the trial before it had started. And I made a statement to say that no one would convict a white man for killing a black person. I want to recant that. Let me say most. And I believe the jury is back there trying to convince the two black people that they have to acquit. That's why we are going so far into into this trial here. You know, they're trying to find a way to get the man off.
That's what you think?
I do believe. It does nothing about race relations. Things are getting better. Things are changing. They're making changes to education, to better equip young black men to become productive citizens of society, and I'm happy about that. But race relations between our two cultures have just, you know, they haven't changed. They haven't changed since I was younger and since my mom was younger and her mother. They just haven't changed. You know, people perceive blacks as being aggressive and, you know, that's just the way it is. So,
Omar, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts. Fred, Mark, Let's talk about what happens if Michael Dunn is acquitted.
Well, I mean, it's going to be open season. Mm-hmm. Florida has still has the Stand Your Ground law, and this will clarify it, unless whatever happens on appeal. This sort of clarifies that. You don't have if you think he has a gun, if it looks like it, it's going to be open season.
If you can say later that maybe he did have a gun.
It'll be open season on black teenagers who are acting like teenagers have always acted, no matter what race you are. They're rebellious. They're guys together are like a gang, always, no matter what race you are. But with black teens, to folks who are not involved. Remember, he's down in Satellite Beach, Brevard County, Florida. There aren't that many blacks down there, and he doesn't have to deal with them at all. He doesn't have to see them except on television. This is totally out of his world. So when he encounters a situation like this, which is one reason why he fled Jacksonville, because he was afraid that with all the black folk up here, it could scare him to death. So if he flees back to his safe island in Satellite Beach. This guy was born in the Keys. Again, how many blacks are down in the Keys? I mean, come on. You know, the teenagers. He went back to where it was safe for him to be. And that's what we're talking about. Out of this madness, this big city madness. And that's what we're talking about here. But if he's acquitted, it will clarify the law for so many people. And we'll all have to tell our grandsons and sons, hey, if you're traveling around, keep your music down, shut up, because there's no guarantee. One of you could be dead, and the rest of you could be charged with something else.
Right. Jeff Billman.
I think you're absolutely right. And my mic's not on. Oh, yeah. Hey, there you go. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if I were in the African-American community and I had a son, and, you know, the word goes out after Zimmerman and after Dunn that, you know, you can shoot young black men with impunity and just say, hey, I was in danger, I would be terrified. I mean, I would be terrified. That's a dangerous message that you can, you know, sort of post hoc say, hey, you know, he had a gun, he threatened me. Or, you know, the sidewalk was a deadly weapon, he threatened me. And you can kill people for that. And the law will say, all right, cool.
Robert emails the show, Melissa, the justification for the first degree over second degree charges due to Florida's law about the victim's age. Jordan was a minor. He was 17.
I think his birthday was 19th birthday would have been Sunday, I think.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of calls meanwhile as we discuss the verdict which could come today in the trial of Michael Dunn. Let's go to Harold in Jacksonville. Hello, Harold. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Panel. I think what everyone is still take a look at and being realistic about it is that anger and hate is what resulted in Michael Dunn firing his weapon. I don't think fear was a factor. That anger and that hate resulted in him losing control of himself. He immediately responded to it. The results of it is you have a dead youth. I would think that if some character witnesses would have been placed on the stand, there could have been extracted some information that would have revealed that Mr. Dunn had a temper that at times he probably lost control of. But if that was not done, I guess you will never know that with facts. But that's what I think the problem was, anger and hate.
Harold, thanks for your thoughts. I don't believe that any character witnesses testified anything like that during this trial that I recall.
No, there is there's a video that John Phillips had put out.
Somebody just emailed it to me.
About the neighbor, which is
Michael Dunn's neighbor.
Yes, Michael Dunn. If you watch that and it's another person saying this, but it's talking about it's two previous wives and that the neighbor says Michael Dunn had threatened to blow their brains out. That they were fearful of him, says that he saw Michael Dunn doing cocaine, saw him doing smoking pot, all these allegations. So you combine that with, here's a guy who wasn't involved in his son's life, comes up for the wedding, has not only the pistol, spare clip, silencer, nunchucks, and he has the nerve to call somebody else a thug.
And he was drunk. Let's not forget that he'd been drinking. And he was, you know, hot-headed drunks with guns are, it's just a bad combination, especially when they feel disrespected by the black boy who, you know, told him no when he said to turn down his music. It's just a recipe for bad things to happen.
Rob in St. Augustine. Hello, Rob. Good morning.
You know, I think no one's really asking the bigger question, and that's what is wrong with people in this country thinking that it's okay, whether they're defending themselves or not, to kill someone? I've had a gun in my face on four separate occasions over the past four decades, and I can tell you at no time did I feel compelled to go out and get a gun so that if it happened again, I would shoot that person or kill him. It's not even something I would consider. And I've been held up at gunpoint. I've been assaulted with a gun. I felt violated. I felt impotent. But I sure didn't want to go out and get a gun to kill someone because they pointed a gun at me. And I don't understand what's wrong with people to think that that's okay. If they're assaulted or if they're, you know, if they feel that they're being threatened, that it's okay to point a gun at someone and shoot them. It's not acceptable under any circumstance.
Rob, thanks for the call. And let's go to one more caller. It's Richard on the South Side. Hi, Richard. How are you today?
Hey, I'm doing great, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. One of your guests earlier mentioned exactly what I was going to say, but I just want to insert this real quick. The whole reason that the 14th Amendment was written was because during the time of Reconstruction, the whites in the South were coming up with every rule to get around, every law they could get around, any law that was written to protect blacks, they wrote another one to erase it. And Stand Your Ground does nothing but that. Secondly, and it's a chilling reason to be afraid that this thing might go in Dunn's favor. The defense of Zimmerman was able to get the jury to believe that the murder weapon that Trayvon Martin used was the sidewalk. That's crazy. But for them to say that he thought he had a gun, and because he thought he saw one and those thugs could have thrown it in a trash can, that's enough. And your earlier guest said it. I can imagine those two black jurors are fighting like crazy to not buy that nonsense. And so it's unfortunate, but this case may well prove that we've just turned the clocks back 150 years.
Richard, thank you for sharing your thoughts. Man, we have so many callers. We just don't have time to get all of you on. The nation is watching. We're watching and waiting on the Michael Dunn verdict. Thanks so much to our media panel for being with us today. Fred Matthews, Jeff Billman, and Mark Woods, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.